This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The Money. I'm Richard Aidy, and this is The Treasurer.
There's no shortage of challenges right now in the Australian economy. When you combine natural disasters, global uncertainty, this spike in inflation, and what that has meant for rising interest rates as well. And as you all know, today the Independent Reserve Bank increased interest rates again by 0.5% to 1.35%.
I don't know about you, but a little bing went off for me in that last sentence. When he said independent, Jim Chalmers was making it absolutely clear that the rise in interest rates wasn't coming from the government, it was coming from the Independent Reserve Bank. The RBA is trying to stifle inflation by pushing down demand, when most of the inflation's caused by supply issues. It has its work cut out. And it's not the only central bank facing challenges or criticism. Howard Davis chairs the NatWest Bank in Britain, but he's a former deputy governor of the Bank of England. Howard, the key criticism of several of the Reserve Banks is that they've been too slow to deal with inflation.
Yes, I think so. And I think that has applied to all of the major central banks. The Federal Reserve has been perhaps more upfront about acknowledging those failures than the others. You know, the Fed kept saying last summer that inflation was transitory, and then Jay Powell, the chairman, said in November, we are retiring the word transitory, which was quite an interesting acknowledgement of the fact that they'd really misread it. So, yeah, I think they're all in a dock for the same charge as far as misreading the inflationary pressures of last year, which we're now seeing emerge very strongly this year.
But the European Central Bank still hasn't begun to raise rates, as I understand it.
That is absolutely right. Now, the European Central Bank, of course, faces a particular set of challenges in that it has to set monetary policy for a very diverse area. So at the moment, you know, you've got inflation still below 4% in France, and you've got it at about 12 or 13% in Lithuania and the rest of the Baltics. So they're trying to aim for the middle of a very broad range. There are now, however, plenty of critics of saying that they are getting that a bit wrong. The Germans are particularly concerned because the Germans have a phobia about inflation for all the historical reasons we well understand. And so, yeah, the ECB has been slow, but they have signalled that they will raise rates at their next meeting, which is in itself a slightly unusual thing to do. But anyway, they are on the move.
They really do have a very difficult task because they're trying to construct a way of addressing raising borrowing costs to combat inflation, while at the same time trying to keep a lid on borrowing costs in the terms of bond yields for the most indebted members. The technical term, I think, for this is tricky.
Yeah, one of the most well-informed critics of the ECB once said, the ECB makes a perfect monetary policy for a country that doesn't exist, which I think is quite a good way of putting it. And at the moment, they do face, as you suggest, a particular issue, which is that as rates rise, the past record suggests that the spread between the borrowing costs of, let's say, Italy and Germany widen. And given that Italy has got 140% of GDP debt, that if Italian debt servicing costs rise sharply, that could be pretty fatal for the fiscal position of Italy. So what they're trying to do at the moment is on the one hand raise rates for everybody a bit, and on the other hand devise an instrument which will allow them to buy more Italian bonds than German bonds in order to keep the Italian interest rates down. The problem with that is that the German Constitutional Court has suggested that they cannot use monetary policy in this unbalanced way, as they would put it. In other words, that they must buy in a market neutral way and just buy the volume of Italian bonds reflected by the volume of Italian bonds in the market, not in a disproportionate way in order to affect their borrowing costs. That issue is currently the big issue of debate within the corridors of the ECB.
It does sound as if they're trying to juggle plates while on a unicycle, blindfolded, and now they're only being allowed to use one hand, if I could put it that way.
Yep, I think that's it. And I'm afraid these problems reflect some problems in the construction of the Eurozone, where there is no central fiscal policy, there is no Minister of Finance, And indeed, in many cases, you know, faced with that sort of dilemma, a normal central bank in a normal country would turn back to the finance minister and say, look, there's only so much we can do. You better sort this out. And of course, there's no one to send that message to in the Eurozone.
No, indeed. Now, is this wider critique of central banks warranted? Because, and there are legitimate reasons, and we've started to talk about a few of them. Or is it also that we've had these expectations of what central banks can achieve? They've been sort of seen as these rock stars with godlike powers.
Yeah, there was a point at which, in thinking of Forbes, most powerful people in the world, you know, there were two central bankers in the top 10. And even some central bankers at the time said, whoa, hang on, you know, we're being set up to fail here. And I think that prediction has come home to roost, that after the financial crisis, the problem was liquidity in markets. And central banks are quite good at dealing with that. You know, they do know how to inject liquidity into markets, and they did so really rather effectively. I think the problem we've got now is a slightly different one. You know, there are fiscal problems after the COVID crisis because governments spent a lot of money. The central bank can't solve that. And all kinds of inequalities building up, given the way in which countries supported their economies during COVID, the central banks find it difficult to deal with inequalities. There's the green transition. You know, central banks talk a lot about it, but do they have the tools to be able to do that? So I think we're now in a position where the expectations placed on central banks are really ones that they can't deliver. And I think some kind of reset of what a realistic set of central bank objectives is something that is going to be necessary, because otherwise, as you point out, they are set up to fail.
Yeah. Well, should they start by perhaps being a bit more transparent? And, you know, they have moved a long way. Greenspan, and you quote him in the piece, actually famously said, you know, that the ability to mumble incoherently has been enormously important for me. They have moved a long way. Our own governor of the RBA makes a lot of speeches compared to RBA governors of the past. Is it about greater transparency and owning up to their own limitations?
This is a very, very tricky question. And the honest answer is that different central banks do approach this rather differently. You know, we have a very, very transparent process here where there are nine members of the Monetary Policy Committee, four of them outsiders to the bank. Then all their votes are recorded, plus the details of why they've voted in the way they have. And so, in theory at least, you should in the UK be able to see the evolution of central bank thinking such that you don't get surprises in the way that you do in some other places. And I think that's probably been true in Australia in the last couple of weeks. Because here, you know, you observe the voting changing and the reasons that individuals are giving for their votes. And that, in principle, allows the markets to get a better idea of what the central bank is likely to do in the next few months. Now, the counter-criticism that you sometimes hear in this jurisdiction is, well, too much information already. There are too many signals given out by the central bank, and you've got nine Monetary Policy Committee members all making speeches. So setting this balance of how transparent you want to be is a tricky one. I mean, the aim is, if central banks give people out there in the economy, whether price setters or wage bargainers, a good idea of how they will behave in different future states of the world, that will make the cost of delivering low inflation less. Because people will say, whoops, if I demand a wage increase, you know, I'm just going to find that interest rates will rise and I'm going to pay more for my mortgage and therefore I'm going to end up back where I started. So what you need to do is to give the markets information about how you will react to different sets of circumstances. And that's the tricky balance. I think maybe some central banks get that better than others.
You paraphrase the financial writer Edward Chancellor in his book, The Price of Time, that monetary authorities have been too focused on one thing, which is consumer price inflation, and neglected others. Do you think that's a fair point?
Yes, I think that one of the lessons of the financial crisis was that in the run-up to the financial crisis of 2008, that the central banks were looking at the inflation rate and they were saying, well, it's fine, everything's fine. So they were like a driver driving along their motorway precisely at the speed limit of 70 miles an hour, but the engine was overheating, the tyres were running flat, the oil was dropping out the bottom of the engine, and eventually there was an explosion. The analogy being that they were saying inflation is fine, but you know, house prices were rocketing, other asset prices were rocketing. There were all kinds of fancy transactions undertaken in the financial markets based on very dubious asset valuations, which looked ready for a fall. But the central bank said, no, inflation's okay. Now, I think, therefore, the case for saying you need to look at a broader range of indicators, and particularly asset prices, is now, I think, a strong one. And that's one of the points that Chancellor makes powerfully in his book.
Yeah, he says that this paradigm needs serious rethinking. So, and monetary authorities need different objectives, which might be looking at asset price inflation, might be one of them, and enhanced accountability. What are we talking about here, Howard?
Well, the problem here is that, and here's where I'm not entirely in line with Chancellor, I have to say, is that there are different sorts of accountability you need for different tasks. I think we probably, in the most of the developed world, people would accept that monetary policy, it makes sense to have a very independent central bank because politicians find it very difficult to manipulate interest rates because they're always tempted to do so before an election. But once you give central banks other tasks, you know, financial stability tasks, also actual regulation, which we have here, which you don't have in Australia in the same way, then you enter a territory where you need different sorts of accountability because you're then dealing often with, you know, relative property prices, with property rights, effectively. You know, you are favouring one set of people in the economy over another set of people, which in interest rate policy you're not doing. And therefore, you do need a different type of accountability. And that, to me, says that there's a danger in shoving too much responsibility into a central bank because then the governor finds him or herself going to Parliament, answering questions about interest rates and saying effectively, look, that's my business. You've given me that task. I'll do it the way I can. And then being asked questions about banks and bank asset prices and things and having to be accountable in a different way. And that makes the very broad central bank, such as we have in the UK, quite vulnerable because it's quite difficult for it to explain just what it's accountable for and to whom.
We are here in Australia. The new government has said there will be a review of the Reserve Bank of Australia. This is there's bipartisan agreement on this, so it'll certainly happen. And should this be viewed as an opportunity?
Yeah, I think so. And indeed, I don't think that should be seen as a sort of vote of no confidence in Reserve Bank, because a lot of central banks elsewhere have had such a review. You know, our former governor, Mervyn King, did a review of the Swedish Riksbank, actually, which is the one central bank in the world which is older than the Bank of England, as a matter of fact. And we've had people from the Fed do reviews of the Bank of England here, particularly of things like its forecasting record, where there are obviously, you know, questions for the RBA to answer there, about communications, about transparency, about issues like forward guidance. Does that make sense? Is it not? So I think the process of having a review, which, as I understand it, hasn't happened in Australia for quite a long time, is a healthy one. And on the whole here, the outcomes of those reviews have been generally regarded as pretty constructive by the Bank of England. They haven't turned into, you know, political arguments.
Well, plenty to think about. And it was great to get that broader perspective on this today. Thanks very much for joining us, Howard.
You're welcome.
Howard Davis is chair of NatWest, and my apologies for the line quality there.
Tonight, brace yourselves for a rough night ahead. Authorities prepare for heavy rain and the worst flooding in Greater Sydney in more than 18 months.
Well, you know what happened next. Days of torrential rain, a massive flood, thousands evacuated. We don't yet know how much all of this will cost. The Hawkesbury Nepean Valley has a history of flooding that's very well known. So why do we seem to be caught out like this again and again? Well, it's complicated, according to geographer Brian Robert Cook from the University of Melbourne.
There are these environmental factors due to precipitation and river dynamics and shape. And then there's social practices around development. There are economic forces around where we invest and how we do that investment. There's history and there's psychological forces in terms of human behaviors. There's just absolutely everything coming together to affect this situation.
Well, I want to unpack some of that, but
yeah,
because one of the things you said was history.
Yeah.
So Windsor, which of course is one of the principal settlements, it's a town that would think of itself as beyond Sydney, but of course it's part of the greater Sydney area, has a history of floods, including the most horrific one, which happened in the 1800s.
Yeah.
And yet we have allowed and indeed encouraged, I think now 134,000 people live in that valley. That number is expected to double in the next 20 years. What is going on?
Yeah, it's this fascinating process that I think we could notice all over the world or all over much of the Western world. We have these conflicting interests. We have populations that are desperate to own their own homes and to begin that sort of life stage. We have a society that values and rewards that sort of home ownership. We also have a society that invests in home ownership. So there's lots of people using homes as an investment property. So there's, you know, pressure on these places to live. And then we have local councils that depend on investment and the jobs associated with homes and development. So you've got their sort of interests in creating a tax base and contributing to development in their region. You have politicians who want to cut some ribbons and look as though they're contributing to development and facilitating investment in their region. There's just so many things that are tied to home ownership in Australia and much of the world that we're driven to be as permissive as possible when we're considering where we allow and encourage development. And flooding's there, you know, as you say, flooding is something we are well aware of in the vast majority of these locations. And yet it's not a top priority until the water starts lapping at the edge of the home. And I think that that's a really important thing to recognize. I spend my life trying to convince people in government that simply communicating information doesn't lead people to make better decisions. There is so much more to behavior and decision-making than being aware. And I think this sort of flood and these events are the types of outcomes that happen when we have these competing values that we all are subject to.
Well, yeah, and I think there's this idea that we've heard a lot about this week, and we heard a bit about when Lismore happened too, of this 1-in-100-year flood.
Mm.
Now, of course, that's not how it's really phrased. It's really the risk of flooding is 1% in a year. And we know that climate change is meaning floods are bigger, but people go, well, it's a 1-in-100 years. I might only be here 20 years. I don't have to worry about it.
Yeah. When you talk to flooding people, they just hate the 1-in-100-year term because it is this kind of deceptive. You think you understand, oh, you know, it happened last year, therefore I got 99 years here, I'll be fine. And it really isn't that. It's exactly what you said. It's a 1% chance of this flood happening every year. Now, the thing that's quite interesting about those is they're modeled, they're predicted, and they're based on limited data and all sorts of challenges that come with inscribing that 1-in-100-year or that 1% flood line. And we have changing dynamics too. We have a system that's alive. And so we can say climate change is a perfect example of precipitation patterns varying, of the intensity, the timing of it, all changing. But we've also got massive land use change, which means that deforestation upstream or river works upstream or the construction of a highway, of a train line, of a new development, these are all things that contribute to a changed environment, which then means that in a river system where you have lots of rivers coming together, like you do in the Nepean Hawkesbury Valley, that you're affecting the peak flows that come through that river system.
Mm.
When floods happen is when peaks run through that system and they coincide. And so if you've got two different rivers kind of coming together and they're both at their peak, that's when we see those really bad floods.
Mm.
And when we start intervening in a river system and we chop down the forest or something, that might speed up one of those rivers, which might mean that the peaks come through at the same time or at a different rate. And that can really, going back to your 100-year flood question, it upsets what we would know historically. It messes with what we think we know.
Yeah, and of course, what seems clear is that what we thought we knew is not quite turning out to be what we're getting. The other thing that we have to kind of acknowledge, I think, is that if you draw a line on a map and say, well, this is the 1-in-100-year,
yep,
but the people who own the land lobby to say, well, perhaps that mark could be reconsidered and we could move it a bit. I mean, these things happen. If you succeed in getting your land rezoned, you stand to make a lot of money. That has surely influenced how parts of Western Sydney have been developed.
This is what's called the levy effect, or this is one key element of what's called the levy effect. And it's this conversion of relatively worthless land into extremely valuable land. And put yourself in that landowner's shoes, and all of us would probably find a way to rationalize this petition that we would give to the local council to say, oh, you know, that modeling that you've done to designate the 1% floodline, you know, it's using old data, and I've got a consultant here who I've commissioned to do a new study, and the updated data says the line can be moved a little bit off, and oh, look, the land that I own is free of the 1% flood, and I should be allowed to develop that. And, you know, that could be many millions of dollars of implication for that landowner. And so when we have that happening all along the edges of a river catchment, we're just nibbling in. We're just kind of taking a little bite out of the floodplain here and a bite out of the floodplain there. And it happens over here too. And gradually you see the shrinking of the catchment as we intrude into the 1% floodline. Now, the thing I think that gets missed in this, and it goes back to your point about the one in 100 year floodline, is that that 1% floodline is kind of, it's not unimportant, but we see floods that exceed the 1% floodline all the time, which means this idea that if you're on the good side of the 1% floodline, you're somehow safe or fine, you're clearly not. And so by having a discussion about the 1% line, maybe we're missing a discussion that says, geez, you know, maybe the 1% line isn't a great line to be building to.
You mentioned the levy effect, and that makes me think about engineering, Brian. We're a wealthy country. Can't we channel these forces of nature so that we can live safely in these areas?
It's such a tempting question, and I think you've put your finger on one of the key elements of flood risk in much of the world. And for me, I think it goes back to the post-Second World War period. The West had come out of a successful war. They'd harnessed the atom. They had all these servicemen in need of jobs. And we had the hubris to say we could tame nature, we could control nature. And in the period after that, we poured an awful lot of concrete in service of environmental management to enable development. When you look at the dams, the embankments, the large-scale river management schemes, a lot of them come through that period or come during that period. And what we found was the more technical intervention we do, we actually end up encouraging more investment. If we build an embankment, the people who live on the safe side of the embankment go, hey, this is great. I'm gonna build a second home, or I'm going to expand, I'm going to invest. And the people who own the property around you think it's very safe, and they'll propose a development. And you actually end up encouraging this more intensive use of the land immediately around the embankment or in the protected zone. Now, every embankment is designed to fail. They have a limit. You know, they're built to a particular level. And sooner or later, the water is going to come over that embankment. And if we've spent the period since investing and putting assets at risk and putting more people in there and building more infrastructure, then that helps us to kind of understand and explain why the costs of flooding are going up so astronomically.
Well, what it means, though, is that people say, well, we've got this bit of infrastructure that protects us, and it means we must invest in more infrastructure to protect protect us better. So we put billions and billions of dollars into trying to control these forces that ultimately we're not going to control.
Yeah. Where we decide, or how we decide whether to invest in flood mitigation, is we run cost-benefit analyses, right? We go, does it make sense for us to invest this X amount of money into an embankment to protect X amount of assets? And the more we do it, the more assets get placed in proximity, which makes it a stronger case than using the cost-benefit analysis to do more. Mm. And so the logic of protection, experience a flood, demand more protection, you know, just cycles back and forth. All the while, those kind of large-scale events are probably happening on a 20 or 50-year kind of recurrence rate, which means you can go a whole generation with people with their false sense of security that the floods are taken care of.
Well, of course, the people of Lismore and now the people of the Hawkesbury Nepean Valley, west of Sydney, will feel that they've been bitten more than once in the last 18 months. What realistically should we be doing if building infrastructure is not going to get us there?
Oh, if you could come up with a solution for this, you can quit your job and be rich, because everybody will want to know the answer to that. It's going to be an awfully difficult process. This is going to be a conflict. It's going to have winners and losers, and we're going to have to navigate that in a really kind of sensitive way, because we will be dealing with individuals who are affected by floods, who have a lot of their personal capital tied up in their home. That's the inheritance for their children, or that's, you know, their primary asset. For it to become less valued, people will fight tooth and nail. And we shouldn't be surprised at that. And I think we shouldn't expect otherwise. What we need to do is be very empathetic to the people who are experiencing these events. And we're going to need to spend a lot of money. And we can spend that money in disaster relief and further technical interventions into river systems, or we can focus that money on withdrawing from floodplains. That is such a sensitive topic. And I was thinking about the best cases where this has happened. And following a huge flood in 1993 along the Mississippi, there was probably the largest evacuation of homes that I'm aware of, about 12,000 homes. And they were bought out. They were kind of incentivized. There were tax breaks. They did all sorts of things up and down the Mississippi to encourage homes that were at flood risk to move. By 2005, when another massive flood came through there, they've done studies and found that there was 28,000 additional homes in the flood-prone area where they had tried to evacuate others. And so I think when we're having discussions about withdrawing from floodplains, we really have to recognize the power of all these forces that are encouraging and incentivizing individuals to buy homes in there.
With a three-year political cycle at federal level and a four-year political cycle at state level, it does seem difficult for anybody to actually grasp this mettle and make a fundamental change as big as abandoning a part of the country where we've lived for a long time.
There are steps that we can take right now. And if I had a wand and I was going to wave it, I would say things like, all right, when a parcel of land is designated at flood risk, there should be a 50-year moratorium on development. Just to put the brakes on this process of encroachment that just says, if someone's had a go, if someone said this parcel of land should be developable and the local council refuses and that goes through the courts and it's withheld, it should go on a timeout. You're not allowed to be developed for 50 years or however long, so that our local councils aren't being bombarded by these applications by aspiring landowners to convert worthless land into really valuable land.
That might be the point to finish this. Thank you very much for joining me today on The Money.
Oh, thank you so much, Richard.
Brian Cook from the University of Melbourne. That's it for now. The Money is produced by Kate McDonald. I'm Richard Ady.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.